Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld. Stay tuned to two interviews I did at the New Living Expo in LA in February 2018. Part one will be my interview with Lynn McTaggart. Part two is an interview with Dr. Jacob Lieberman about the visions of light. Stay tuned.
Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld. I am so happy to be back here with a good friend, Lynn McTaggart, her new book, The Power of Eight. Thanks, Lynn. Another breakthrough, really.
Oh, thank you very much, Alan.
Field, and then the intention experiment, then the bond, and now the power of eight, kind of pulling together all your research and saying, wow, there really is something happening here. Tell us about how it got started and how you didn't really believe what was happening.
Well, that was the amazing thing about it, Alan. Yes. When I started, I didn't really believe in the power of intention, I have to admit.
When you started the intention experiment?
Yes.
Were you just humoring yourself?
No, when all kinds of things like the law of attraction came out and the secret, I had a lot of inconvenient questions. Mm-hmm. I kept saying to myself, how powerful is this consciousness? I mean, there was plenty of evidence in the field from the scientists.
The field was all about the collective mind activating a greater possibility, right?
Well, and it was about the fact that, there was a lot of evidence mm-hmm. by those scientists showing that thoughts are an actual something with the capacity to change physical matter. So the journalist in me, remember I started out life as an investigative reporter.
That's right.
The skeptical journalist in me kept saying, well, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about just shifting a quantum particle, or are we talking about curing cancer? Mm-hmm. How far can we take this? And also, what happens when lots of people are thinking the same thought at the same time? Does it magnify the effect? Now, I didn't know the answer to any of those questions,
I doubted it.
I didn't know if it was going to work. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, I'll put it to the ultimate test. Being the doubting Thomas I was, I said, okay, let's create the biggest experiment in the world about this. And so I knew a lot of these scientists in consciousness
this
research.
This was the intention experiment.
Yeah. Yes. When I was putting that together, I knew all of these scientists in consciousness research, and I also had my book, the field was in 30 languages by then. So I thought, well, if I just put that audience together with those scientists, I'll have the biggest global laboratory in the world. So that's what we did. And I had no idea if it was going to work. I thought, okay, let's give it a shot. And the weird thing is, it worked. I mean, it really worked.
What was the biggest extension experiment in the world that worked?
Well, the point was, they all worked. I mean, I've run 30 to date where we've had the measurable responses. We're still working on the responses.
Give me an example of what worked in that. Like, what did you set up and what was the result?
Well, one of my favorite experiments was a very simple one. We started out with the different scientists. They wanted to start out small. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wanted to try to get people out of burning buildings with our thoughts and cure cancer. Mm-hmm. And, I'd talk to the scientists and say, yeah, let's do something big. And they'd say, let's start with a leaf. And it was a little frustrating, but I could get that they wanted to take baby steps because we were doing something that hadn't been tried before. So we started out with leaves and seeds. And one of the experiments I did with the University of Arizona, Dr. Gary Schwartz and his team, was simple seed experiment. We'd have four sets of seeds. Mm-hmm. They would send me photographs of the seeds. There'd be 30 in each. If I was speaking somewhere, I would do the experiment, over the internet we would do it, and I'd have the audience choose one of the sets of seeds. We wouldn't tell the scientists.
A, B, C, or D.
A, B, C, or D. We wouldn't tell the scientists which ones we were taking. We would send intention to that picture, and then the scientists would plant all four sets of seeds afterward, and only after they'd measured them after 5 days, I think it was, would we tell them which one we'd sent intention to. Now, the first time I did this experiment, we've run it 12 times. The first time I did this, I was in Sydney, Australia, in front of an audience of 700. We did exactly as I said. Remember, those seeds are sitting back there in a lab in Tucson, Arizona. We are 8,000 miles away.
And just looking at pictures of the seeds.
And it wasn't the seeds themselves. It was a photographic representation of the seeds. So that in itself was pretty amazing. Because I started getting the idea, we're creating some sort of psychic internet.
But the results were what?
The seeds, in every single instance, the seed sent intention grew significantly higher than
really, and you could tell
every single
time. This
no,
is
no,
the seed.
This was measured.
Amazing.
This was measured. So that was pretty unassailable. But
and you were surprised, right?
Well, I was surprised because I was shocked. But what I was shocked at too was the overall thing that happened, which was of the 30 we've run to date, 26 have shown measurable, mostly significant effects. And that's been everything from trying to do very subtle things to properties of leaves, to making seeds grow faster, to purifying water, to lowering violence in war-torn areas, to healing somebody of PTSD. But that isn't the interesting part of the story.
Okay, that's pretty interesting.
It says a lot about human consciousness.
Right.
But what happened, the really interesting part of the story, it happened in 2008. About a year after I'd started these experiments, I'm thinking to myself, I'd run a number of experiments now, and I thought, well, people in this situation should run workshops. Now, I'd only run a few workshops at that point, and I wasn't sure how we could have an experience that would replicate the big things that were happening with the intention experiment. So I'm sitting there with my husband one day, and I go, oh, I don't know. I'll just put them into groups of eight or something like that, and I'll have them send healing to some member of the group with a health challenge. And my husband's a great headline writer. He's also a journalist. And he goes, great, the power of eight. I like it. Mm. So we have our first experiment in Chicago, our first workshop. We put people into groups of eight. I'm telling them to all hold hands or make sure it's an unbroken connection and do this and do that. And while I knew that... I knew about certain things that make intention work better. I worked with a number of intention masters for the book, The Intention Experiment, and I'd also studied what worked best with intention in the lab.
What works better for intention?
Being specific, a highly focused and energized state of mind, sending it out through the heart. Mm-hmm. Being very specific is one of the most important things.
Right. Yeah. Be careful for what you ask for.
Exactly.
Okay.
But be very specific about what you ask for. So I knew all of that. But I didn't know how to do anything with this group intention. So I asked that we go through it. And I figure it's going to be a nice little feel-good exercise, like having a facial. So the next day we have them back. We hand them the mic and turn. And they say stuff like this. They say, you know, I had terrible arthritis and my knee was really bad and I'm walking normally today. I had IBS for years and years and years, and my stomach feels normal today. I have terrible migraines. I have them every day of my life. My headache's clear. And on it went for about an hour.
Wow.
Ryan and I, my husband and I, are looking at each other with our mouths open. We don't know what to make of this. And I didn't believe it. I had a problem with this. I said, this is a big placebo effect. I don't believe that we're doing anything, you know. And I, you know, as any journalist could tell you, I buried the lead of the story. So, but I carried on doing workshops, and in every workshop I did, I was trying this out. And every time, there were these amazing healings. We had somebody with cataracts who said she was 80% better afterward. We had loads of people with arthritis who were walking normally the next day. We had a woman with MS who came the next day without her crutches. We had a woman recently who had had a stroke. She couldn't focus her eyes. She said her eyes were focusing normally afterward. You know, we had hundreds, maybe thousands of this over the years. And to everyone, I just couldn't figure it out. I couldn't figure out what this was. And I didn't understand what one of the people who had been part of it was telling me. Was trying to tell me, and she said, I felt like she was a receiver, but she said, she was a sender. Mm-hmm. And she said, I felt like I was sending and receiving healing all at the same time, like I was healing myself.
As she was trying to heal someone else,
yes,
she was healing herself.
Herself.
How do you explain that?
Well, and I saw, that was the other thing that pushed me beyond placebo effect, because a lot of the senders were getting healed. I mean, recently, I ran some Mile High Church group, Power of Eight groups, and in Mile High Church in Denver. And one of the people who was doing the sending was a guy called Wes. Now, Wes had big dreams as a young man. And he was going to university. He was at college, and he was studying science. And his last year, he got drafted, had to go to the Vietnam War, never finished his degree. And that experience was so traumatic. It was the last year of the Vietnam War. You know, you didn't have lottery anymore. And he came back so depressed and so traumatized. And his bad luck carried on for years and years and years. And one, you know, he was just a kind of downward spiral. And the one light in his life, his second wife, didn't last very long. She died of cancer. Mm-hmm. And he was stuck with terrible bills that he had to drive a truck to pay for. And it was just an awful story. And he had got to the point at the age of 65 where he had said to himself, what's the use?
Right.
And he was having a hard time even getting up in the morning. So when he was participating, he didn't want to put himself forward because there was somebody in the group with cancer, and they focused on her.
Yeah.
By the way, she was a stage 4. She went down to a stage 1 afterward, amazing. Which was just amazing. But what happened to Wes was so interesting. He had such an amazing experience that the next day he started waking up, and it was like, suddenly the grass was greener, the birds were more beautiful.
By sending healing energy to this.
He then suddenly totally recovered his joie de vivre.
Wow.
He got up, was excited. It was very easy to do things. He's suddenly starting to do power walking. He was doing 90 minutes of power walking, lifting weights.
Just through one sending.
One sending. Wow. And his life kept getting better. He started writing. And he had this amazing dream where he met his 19-year-old self again, and this 19-year-old self said to him, Wes, there's still time. And it was just unbelievable. But we had so much of that where the senders were getting healed too. So I had a hard time with all of this, Alan. It's taken me 10 years to write this book because I didn't know how to explain this. So the
you're
book
a scientist.
Is,
you have a scientific mind, so you want to put it into a science, right?
Well, the journalist in me has never gone away, the investigative reporter.
Right.
So I needed to understand, why is this happening? Somebody thought of this before me. Why is this going on? Why is this so potent?
Yes.
You know, and it was so fascinating to go through this. And also, I needed to study it. I needed to put these groups to the test.
So what did you discover about the science of thought and sending? I mean, what is the science? I mean,
well, it's a little bit of everything, Alan. It's, yes, the power of intention, more and more. We have so much evidence that thoughts are not just things, but thoughts are things that affect other things.
Thoughts are things like energy? Like if I send you a thought, I'm sending you energy? Is that what...
It's
what
not
saying?
An electromagnetic energy
no,
that
it's...
you can measure or whatever, because it doesn't dissipate over space. You know, look at what happened with our psychic internet.
Right.
You know, but consciousness is a kind of energy. It's a kind of a, it's a ever-present, it's an ever-present entity that gets directed. I think that's really more like what it is.
So we need a new science, I think, is what you're saying, that will explain things like thoughts as...
Oh, God, definitely. The old story is, that's really been my work.
It
is
has
all
been.
Been telling the new story, because the old story is really out of date. The old story is all about, you know, it's a Newtonian vision of separate objects that operate according to fixed laws in time and space. Very well-behaved separate things.
And thoughts don't mean anything, and there's a separation between mind and body. And
yeah,
all
and
that.
All these thoughts are encased inside your head and don't trespass into other people and
but
things.
But they do.
But they do.
So
and so there's that evidence that consciousness is something that's all-pervasive and can get directed and can affect other things.
Mm.
But there is also some other really interesting evidence. There's obviously group effects. There's a lot of evidence about what Emile Durkheim, the French psychologist, used to call collective effervescence
well,
of a group.
Well, if two or more gather, there's that
yes.
quote from the Bible, which is like, two or more gather, something else is happening there.
Well, talk about the Bible. Before I get on to altruism, I was looking to say, somebody thought about this
yes.
before me. You know, and I started looking through all through esoteric practices, indigenous practices, other religions. And prayer groups are nothing new. You know, all the different religions. There's minions in the Jewish religion,
wow.
and there's the prayer groups that Teresa de Avila started, and, you know, they
Quaker
all have
stuff
them.
And all that.
They all have them,
Scientific.
And the Rosicrucians did some very stuff like that. I was looking into mystical Christianity, everything. I talked to a couple of experts. What they had never heard of was the reciprocal power of this prayer, essentially.
The healing power of the sender, you said.
That's it. Uh-huh. So I'm looking and I'm looking, and I finally come across an interesting sermon by a Protestant preacher in the early part of the 20th century. And he was saying that there had been a mistranslation in the Bible. And this was in the part of the Bible called the Acts, which is all about what the apostles did in setting up the church and spreading the word of Jesus after he supposedly ascended. And it talks about how they prayed, about 12 or so times. And it always, in the King James translation, that is the one we all read, it says they prayed with one accord. Mm. Now, that is a very anemic translation of the original.
That's a funny way of reading.
But it is, because the real word, the Bible was originally written in the Hellenic Greek, and the original term for how they prayed was homothumadon, which is a word, it's actually a musical term, it's an adverb, and it means passionately with one voice.
Oh.
Think of a Beethoven symphony.
Passionately with one voice.
Yes.
One
directed.
Yes,
exactly. So, and if you look at the context, Jesus is always telling them, you do this and you will be healed and you will heal. And it was always, you pray as one. You pray together as one. And when you're setting up, one of the first things they did was they got together about 120 people with the first church, were the first church, and they all prayed as one. So I started thinking about all kinds of things, that maybe it was no accident, he had 12, maybe there was some important thing about maintaining this group.
There's a geometric progression, 12 around the one, you can fit 12 balls around one single one. So there's 12 that touch the singularity.
That's so interesting. All of this could have been part of it. And also when Judas, of course, he was the betrayer who hanged himself. When he left the group, one of the first things they did was replace him, even though the replacement had not been there to witness Jesus.
Who replaced Judas?
Gosh, yeah. But they replaced him, and that was really an important. Obviously, maintaining the 12 was important to them. So perhaps this was the first healing intention circle.
Well, 12 is a sort of number of months of astrological signs. 12 does keep showing up for some reason.
Who knows? Right. But it was really interesting to me that there was this idea of praying together, almost like a symphony, where it's individual sounds that come together as a collective voice.
To make the one sound.
Yeah.
So in altruism, then, it's also part of this.
One of the things that really fascinated me was I decided to study this for a year. So I run a master class every year, an intention master class now. And what I had decided in 2015 was to run it for an entire year. So I would go through some training for the first 6 weeks, and then I'd put people into groups and I'd watch them. Mm-hmm. So I had about 250 people sign up, and we put them into groups, and I asked them to fill out forms month by month by month. What were their intentions? How were they in terms of their health, their career, their relationships,
these
their life purpose?
Intentions, not the sending energy.
Well, they were meeting together in groups every single week, virtually. They would meet on Skype or whatever, meeting together always. They were all put in groups of eight or so. And I would watch what was happening to them month by month by month. Now, we had amazing stories of the people who continued to meet in groups. We had one guy, a psychologist, who was embarrassed to admit that he had terrible clinical depression for most of his life. And he tried everything. He was an integrative psychologist. He tried everything. Nothing was working. And he had the group send an intention for him to find out the reason. And he found out through some investigation that finally, after years of this, we found out in just this group that one of his liver filtration systems wasn't working, and that was sending toxins to his brain.
Oh, really?
And as soon as he sorted that, he felt so much better. It is really cleared up. So then we had another woman who'd had 15 years of chronic fatigue to the point where she couldn't exercise for more than 5 minutes without being totally exhausted. And They sent attention again for her to find out the cause. She discovered there was black mold in her dressing room, just behind her dressing room, and that was causing it. As soon as she fixed that, she's now lifting weights and going on hikes. Mm. And, you know, on and on. We had amazing windfalls. We had people get dream jobs. Not everybody had that.
Right.
A few people, just a few, in the middle of the year, weren't getting anything. They were not going anywhere. And one of them was a woman called Andy. Andy was going through a divorce. She had sold her gift store, and she needed new work. And she was trying everything to intend that she gets steady work, and she has it in using her skill set, which was very good in marketing and coaching and all of that. Nothing. And we even tried going back to deal with, tried to scarcity issues and all kinds of stuff. Nothing. So finally, I just said, Andy, just get off of yourself. Start intending for someone else. And the someone else I had in mind was a step for, I run a thing called Intention of the Week, where we just put out to the whole community some people to intend for who have health issues. And one of the members of my community wrote in, stepdad, wrote in about his 15-year-old stepson who had broken up with his first serious girlfriend and in a fit of existential adolescent angst had thrown himself off a 40-foot structure onto hard ground. It was terrible. No, he was still alive, but everything was broken.
Ooh.
Everything was broken. He had nerve damage, he had brain damage, everything. The doctors didn't think he was going to live. So we set up a healing vigil with our groups for Luke, and we sent intention three times with his stepfather doing a running commentary of exactly what happened at the time we sent intention, etc. And there looked like there were big turnarounds and things going on. So we kept going with it, and here's the interesting point. Well, first of all,
with Andy.
Well, yeah, but Luke got better in record time.
Wow.
He came home, he got better in record time. It was really quite amazing. Maybe it was good doctoring, maybe it was us. But what was really interesting was Andy. The moment she started focusing on Luke, she gets a call out of the blue for a dream job. Mm-hmm. Totally turns her life around.
Wow.
So when I started looking at this, there were several things that were really interesting about it. Number one, the science of altruism. Mm-hmm. Altruism is like a bulletproof vest. It activates certain parts of the body, mm-hmm. like the vagus nerve, which is the longest nerve in the body, and it's like the love nerve. It activates things like, the release of oxytocin, you know, that love hormone that gets released when we have compassion, etc. But it also activates the immune system, and it's like a virtuous circle. So what most people don't understand is that altruism is probably the best vitamin pill you can ever take.
But altruism means feeling good about someone. I'm sending you love. I'm sending you... Is that what you
More
mean
than
by
that. Any act. Mean? Any act, selfless act for someone else.
Selfless act.
And that was what was really happening with our groups.
Mm-hmm.
They were concentrating, because they were meeting weekly and they were really concentrating with a full heart on someone else. That had an amazing positive effect on them.
Something in their mind got out of the way. Is that part of it? Something in their self-absorbed personality?
Yes. And, you know, of our group, of the people who were in groups, pretty much 100% of them, those people who married, 100% of them who met weekly and carried on meeting religiously and intending for other people had major life transformations, either major healings. You know, one woman repigmented, she had vitiligo. You know, the other, so we had dream jobs, we had financial windfalls. One woman was down to her last 200.
This is incredible pounds. What you're telling me. 100% of people had some kind of amazing transformation.
Yeah, you know, making up with estranged parents, all kinds of things like that. Well, I wanted to find out the real mechanism here.
Yes.
And so Life University, the largest chiropractic university in the world, offered to study our Power of Eight groups. And we used EEG machines and put them on people. We used to, we asked for student volunteers. We just had student volunteers among the student population who came and did seven successive Power of Eight groups. And monitoring them, and we monitored the senders. These were people who hadn't even ever meditated before, certainly had never done Power of Eight groups.
Right.
And almost immediately, their brains went into an incredible thing of a global quieting of the parts of the brain that distinguish self from not self, and also those parts of the brain that are involved in worry, doubt, negativity.
So those brain parts of the brains were silent.
Yes.
And something else could come through.
Well, this was the signature, the brainwave signature, identical to the work of Andrew Newberg, who had studied Sufi masters and Buddhist monks in ecstatic prayer. These were people who were experiencing a moment of ecstatic oneness. And that, I think, is the X factor.
Is that the key?
That's one of the keys. I think it's intention, Alan. I think it's altruism. I think it's a group effect. I think it's the brainwave oneness. And then I think there's another X factor. When we get off of ourselves, when we get off of ourselves, amazing things come back to us.
Thank you, Lynn. I think there's another book in there. Like as you put all these factors together, there's a new science that is emerging that maybe you're there to name it, because it doesn't have a name.
No, and it certainly is. The big message is we're a lot bigger and grander than we've been told.
Ladies and gentlemen, Lynn McTaggart, The Power of Eight. Really, all these examples are in the book and more. Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you so much.
Coming up next is my interview with Jacob Lieberman. Again, this program is sponsored by Portal to Ascension. Look for the upcoming Portal to Ascension conference, October 5th, 6th, and 7th at the Atrium Hotel in Irvine, California. Check that out at ascensionnow.org. Stay tuned to Jacob Lieberman.
I'm Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. I'm talking to Jacob Lieberman, a visionary.
I would say just an ordinary sweet guy.
Was it your first book, Take Off Your Glasses and See?
That was the second book. The first book was Light Medicine of the Future.
Jacob has a new book out called
Luminous Life, How the Science of Light Unlocks the Art of Living. What this is about, which is really interesting, is it's not about healing technologies and fixing and all that. It's about uncovering the primal source of life, which is light, and noticing that light guides our life exactly the same way as it guides the life of a plant.
Wait, I want to talk to you about that. Let me absorb that. That's quite a big concept. So say it again.
So you know when the sun comes up
and
touches a plant,
the
plant turns towards the light and literally aligns itself with it to get maximum nourishment from it.
Receptivity,
okay?
Yes.
Humans have the same experience. Literally, our cells, all of our cells have eyes that can detect and respond to light. Now, let me just add to that something. Light is invisible.
Light.
You cannot see light. What we experience is brightness. So when I say that a cell responds to light, what I'm saying is that our cells respond to invisible signals well before we are aware of them, guiding our life, guiding where we're moving to. And so one of the examples I often speak about is we often use this expression, oh, it caught my eye.
Right.
The it is the light. It catches the eye turns towards the light as a reflex, in other words, no effort. And then in that moment with what catches our eye, we sort of get a download of what the next step of our journey is.
So how do we turn towards the light? Is it sunlight you're talking about turning to? What is the light we are turning to as human beings?
Sunlight.
Sunlight.
Yes, sunlight.
Okay.
But there is no difference between sunlight and the light we think of as spiritual light. It's all the same light. See, we think sunlight is like a physical thing.
Yes.
Because we experience brightness. No.
From the sun.
Yeah. It's the energy coming off of the sun, that light, is not something we actually see. We just perceive brightness by day and darkness by night. But at both times, we're being influenced by that light. Every cell in your body is continually changing throughout the day in response to the light overhead.
Would you say be in the sunlight as much as you can? Is that why you live in Hawaii?
I would say that being in the light for specific periods of time each day if possible, without clothing on or at least large areas of your body unclosed, is probably the healthiest thing that you can do.
Direct light or indirect light, it doesn't matter.
Direct, you know, be under the sun. But I would say to people, start with a minute or two. Mm-hmm. Build up by a minute a day. Everything mm-hmm. very gradual. I mean, to give you an idea, we know that light is involved in the synthesis of vitamin D.
Right.
Well, if I say vitamin D, well, it's just a vitamin. Vitamin D is one of the most important vitamins, mm-hmm. which is synthesized through our interaction with sunlight. Why is it important? When you have an ample amount of vitamin D, mm-hmm. your chances of getting cancer are significantly less. Mm. Heart disease, significantly less. Diabetes, all the diseases of civilization, mm-hmm. the diseases that are now epidemic proportions because we're living inside mm-hmm. and we're spending all of our days in front of computers, and all of that stuff is reduced dramatically. Mm-hmm. When we have ample amounts
of
light.
Well, is it true that we get 90% more sunlight when we're totally naked because the genitals can absorb light even quicker and easier than the, you know, regular surfaces of the body? I heard that. We increase our vitamin D content by letting our totally be naked.
I think if you're totally undressed, you're going to get more vitamin D synthesis, because vitamin D synthesis is related to large segments of the body, the legs. Mm. I don't know about the genitals. I'm not familiar with that. But I'm sure that those areas of the body are going to be involved in the process just like every other part. One of the things that's interesting that you just mentioned, one of the things that they're doing now for impotency is they're using near-infrared radiation underneath the genitals to actually increase potency. When I heard about the research from the guy that did it, I said, doesn't that mean that we're actually deficient in light, in sunlight? He said, probably the case. So there could be some truth to exactly what you just said.
Near infrared light is what?
Near infrared light is part of the spectrum, the electromagnetic spectrum that comes off the sun. It's not visible. Mm-hmm. It's adjacent to the red end of the spectrum. But what's critical about near infrared is this. You remember many, many years ago, I had turned Paul on to a non-eating.
Are you hearing that? Okay, sorry. Oh, right. Many, many years ago, you turned Paul Lowe, our good mutual good, onto
a non-eating process.
Right. What was it called?
It was called the no-eating process.
Yeah, the no-eating process.
Yeah. So, of course, we all did that, and it was quite an interesting process.
21 days, wasn't it?
21 days was the beginning of it. Right. I did it for 9 weeks. I think Paul did it even longer.
Yeah.
What's interesting is we did it at the time. We knew something was going on, but we had no idea how. And there was no science behind it. Now there's actual science behind it. What we know now is that only one-third of the energy that your cells create has to do with the food you eat.
Oh, really?
Two-thirds is directly the light you ingest. And the portion of the spectrum that creates that huge increase in production of ATP, of energy by your cells, is the near-infrared.
I see.
So the near-infrared can really vitalize your body, increase the healing process of just about any condition. They're using it now to deal with tinnitus, with macular degeneration, with potency issues, but they're also using it for Parkinson's, for Alzheimer's.
Can you
so
get
on.
That from the saunas, the near-infrared saunas? Have you used those at all?
Most of the infrared saunas are far-infrared.
Oh.
There are some near-infrared saunas, so yes, you could get benefit from there. But near-infrared devices are being sold over-the-counter on Amazon and so on. Mm. And yes, I predict within a few years, everyone's going to have one at home.
But contrary to what you're saying, have you ever done the darkroom process where it's total absence light for 24 hours or 3 weeks?
Sure.
And what is the effect of being in the darkroom?
Oh, you go crazy. No, you're laughing, but I'm being serious. In ancient times, when you were dealing with violent prisoners, what did they do? They put them in the dungeon. Why? That was the darkest place you could go. When you take light out of our lives in the same way as when you take light out of a plant's life, we begin to contract. Mm. Not only do we become depressed, like people in northern latitudes that get seasonal affective disorder, but our body doesn't know the difference between day and night. Mm. And so we really start to lose groundedness. So now let's talk about your 21-day or your
dark room experience.
So that is what happens when you eliminate light. If, however, you enter that kind of a situation, not because you're forced to be in there, but you're invited. Mm-hmm. When you take away the light, you take away the bulk of our stimulation.
Right.
When you take away the stimulation, all of a sudden what you're left with is the mind. Mm-hmm. You're left with the chatter and everything else that goes on, which is essentially what happened when we did this, the no eating process. Mm. You really weren't allowed to have interaction. You weren't exercising. Mm-hmm. You weren't reading. You were just in a room during the day. So the outside world is gone, but the inside world is very magnified. Mm. And all of a sudden, you really become aware of how we are all addicted to doing.
And to the mind, right? And
right,
to chatter.
Right. So there's benefit to that process as an experience to get more in touch with yourself.
So this book is called, again?
Luminous Life, How the Science of Light Unlocks the Art of Living.
The Art of Living. Let's talk about that end of it, because we met through spiritual experiences.
Sure.
And so there's this light that we're attaining, but how does that affect our spiritual evolution? Talk about our awakening as conscious beings in that context.
If you read any level of spiritual text throughout history, they consistently speak of consciousness as light. Biblically, they speak of God as light. Physicists speak of light as the ground of reality. So, you know, when people are not feeling so well, they say, lighten up. When you have a great idea, they said, a light bulb just went on. There's all of these expressions historically we've used about light being related to health, radiant health, a luminous life. So there's some inseparability between what we call light and what we call life. They're like two sides of the same coin. If light is the ground of reality, then light is the formless and life is the formed. Just two sides of the exact same coin. How does it impact our life? When we discover that our lives are being guided by an animating force, which I call light.
We're being guided. I don't know what you mean by guided. I mean,
okay. we have plants here.
Yes, we do.
What's causing them to grow up?
The light. Okay.
If the light was over there, would they be growing this way?
No.
They're always growing towards the light.
So the guiding force is the light.
The light is the guiding
force. Okay, I got that.
And it literally guides all of our physiology as well. There are times of the day you get hungry. That's because of the light. There's times when you have to go to the bathroom. The light is triggering something there. Throughout the day, you have a light cycle and a dark cycle. Every part of your physiology is inseparable from that. So the reason you get up in the morning is because the light comes up. That's when you're really energized. That's when you're making things happen. Then the light goes down and you start getting sleepy. And then you go to sleep. And during the night, when you're resting, your whole body is regenerating itself. So all of those functions from the activity of the day and the regeneration of night, those are inseparable from light. To give you an example, in my first book 26 years ago, Light Medicine of the Future, after I shared all the science behind it, I said the primary purpose of light is to guide us into a state of oneness with life. October of 2017, the Nobel Prize was won by three U.S. scientists because they discovered the molecular mechanism, the mechanism within our cells that is continually reading that light and dark and triggering all the physiological changes.
Oh, really?
So what I'm speaking about is science, and how that science is now beginning to uncover what's happening in our life. And so what is a luminous life? A luminous life is like when the light is able to come through us unimpededly. Give you an example.
Yes, do, because how do we unimpede it?
So if I had a clear piece of glass,
yes,
and it was perfect, it had no imperfections in it, and the sun was shining from this side, the light that went in and the light that went out would be exactly the same. No light would be lost. Now let's imagine the piece of glass was smudged or it had a few little imperfections in it. Some of the light would be absorbed. Some would be reflected. Some would be bent off to the side. Mm-hmm. So less light would come through.
Yes.
If you looked at depictions of people from the past that had awakened, you'll notice they all have light around their heads.
Yes.
That wasn't some artistic add-on. These people were bright. They were illumined.
Their auric field was illuminated.
Right. And what that means is the light is just coming through. There's nothing impeding that light. So the imperfections in the glass are like the ideas of our mind. Mm. The ideas literally impede the flow of this energy. And we believe that these ideas are real. They say, oh, that's my belief.
Right.
But belief means the opposite of truth.
Because it's
just virtual.
Right. It's all conjecture. If you believe something, it's
just an idea.
Yes, right.
It's a continually changing thing.
I call belief make-believe. You want to make believe this, you want to make believe that.
Exactly. Yeah. So this truth that I'm speaking about occurs when the light just moves right through us unimpededly. We all have the same experience, and what happens is when we begin to recognize that we're not driving the car, that something is actually moving us. You know, for instance, you have an interest in asking provocative questions.
Because I want to know.
Yeah, but that's your reason for being. See, you're not doing this because, oh, it's a nice job. And
no,
so
it's definitely not.
You have to do this. This is what, right. And for me, I have to do this. I'm not here because, oh, it's a big moneymaker.
So it's not the
10,000 people came, you know?
It's not the personality. It's something bigger than the personality.
It's our nature. How does this delightenment, if you will, mm-hmm. exhibit itself? We're doing what we love. We're loving what we do. And life just is. And it's very sweet. Mm. And it's not without the difficulties of life. And yet there's something very exciting about it and something very inspiring about it.
So you've dropped into a place in yourself that rests in peace, that non-dual place, some people might call it.
It's a place of trust. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one thing to speak of trust, and it's another thing to be able to lay down and take a nap and fall asleep in the palms of trust.
But was there one moment where that changed for you, where you went from, you know, a thinking person, preparing, doing all the things, and then, boom, I'm just being?
Millions of moments.
But you talked about that moment with your eyes, and
that was a big instance. But there's been many, many big instances. This moment is an instance. Why? We're lost in speaking about what we love, which is the underpinnings of life. This is about as good as it gets.
Okay.
So this is a moment that's launching the next moment. You know, I mean, there are epiphanies that we have.
Right.
That are significant in our lives. And so when someone actually just naturally loves you and sees you, just as a sweet person you are, something could just start crying because it's like, oh my God, I've waited my whole life for that particular moment, you know? And that for me is what my life is about right now. Mm. You know,
it's beautiful. Yeah. Ram Dass says we're all walking each other home.
Yeah. What I love about him, there's no self-importance. Mm. You know, everyone thinks he's special, except him.
Right.
He's just an ordinary mensch, you know? I think that's a sweet place.
Yeah. So this is the essence of the book and your life and...
The essence of the book is that there's a guiding force, a literal guiding force, not just a spiritual one.
An actual physiological, physical
Absolutely.
Guiding force.
Yes.
Okay.
And I speak about that as a foundation. And then I speak about presence, not as something that we're doing, but as a state that we're brought into when that guidance is working through us. And then I speak about consciousness in a different sort of way, not a way that is against what was, you know, what other people say, but something that includes both. And the book shares, it shares practical pieces, but I want to speak about that because everybody says, can you tell me something practical? Because they think that when you're just speaking or sharing something that isn't an exercise, it's valueless. Actually, when the flow of communication is coming through us rather than from us, those words have medicinal value. Mm. They're incredibly powerful. It's not so much what we're doing that creates the impact. It's the fact that we have an epiphany and all of a sudden we see something differently. So
practically.
Yeah. So for instance, I spend some time in the book speaking about breathing. And I share a little simple, you could call it a meditation, but it's only done for 1 minute. And I talk about, rather than doing an exercise for 20 minutes, nobody has 20 minutes these days, why not do a moment when you first open your eyes in the morning? I talk about the fact that a wonderful place to meditate for a moment is when you're sitting on the toilet. That you use a moment here and a moment there, and when you're driving your car in traffic and you don't do anything, you're just aware of this fundamental rhythm that's expanding and contracting. So I introduce, you could say, awareness expanding experiences for 1 minute intervals.
1 minute.
Just
that's
1 minute.
That's all you need.
Yeah, just as a little reminder here, little reminder here, little reminder here. And after a while, those reminders become integrated into our lives. For instance, this morning, I spoke about the fact that I just follow whatever calls me. Whatever enters my eye, catches my eye, it's what I do. So you come to my house during the day, most of the day is not sitting and writing books and working with clients and meditating. Most of the day, washing the dishes, paying the bills, making the bed. All that stuff that we say, yeah, that's unimportant stuff. Same way I wash the dishes is the way I care for my sweetheart, is the way that I love my children.
Really, presence in each of those moments.
That's it. That's it. The way you do one thing is the way you do everything. So why just be present, if you will, for 20 minutes when you're meditating? There's no difference between that and leaving the dishes clean, leaving the counters dry, making a beautiful meal.
Mm.
Life is continually inviting you to attend to something. That is presence. There's nothing to practice. Life is the greatest practice we have for those kinds of activities. So
I get it. One question I wanted to ask you that I heard in your talk, when you had a level of epiphany, you had clear sight, but you went and tested your eyes and your eyes hadn't changed, and yet you could see 300% better.
Right.
How do you explain that?
Well, you see, if we're seeing through our eyes,
yes,
and your eyes don't change, you wouldn't be seeing better.
Right. So,
if you are seeing better and your eyes haven't changed, then maybe our hypothesis about that fact that we see with our eyes, maybe we need to question that, at least look. So that experience opened up some part of me that started looking. what is it that is seeing?
Yes.
Keep in mind that this phenomenon has now resided in my life for 42 years.
You still don't wear glasses?
I don't wear any glasses. I'm 70 years old.
And you did before that.
For nine and a half years.
Right.
And I still have I have more astigmatism today.
If you're not seeing through your eyes, what are you seeing through is the question.
Well, it's not what am I seeing through. You see, we believe that it's us doing the seeing. And my sense is that there's a universal seer. There's something that is noticing everything. You know, we have sensations in the body. Something is aware of them.
Mm-hmm.
We have sensations in the outside world. Something is aware of them. We have sensations inside in this world nobody's ever seen called the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Something is aware of them. What is the something that is aware of them? That's the thing that is noticing. That's the seer. It's not the eye. Mm-hmm. The eye is merely a physical organ that allows light to enter.
So you had a switch there in your nature, in your reality, where it was no longer the person, the individual, the personality. Something is seeing through you.
Right.
And that has clear vision.
Right. And that thing that has clear vision,
uh-huh,
sees everything. Uh-huh. It's omniscient. It's everywhere at the same time. It's just a field of possibility. It's the same seer that the Bible calls God.
Right.
I'm not a religious person. All I'm sharing is that throughout history, people have spoken about this. Most of them were mystics. Some of them are scientists. All I'm saying is, I don't have to understand it. I'm having the direct experience of it. And the direct experience is unquestionable. There is no part of me that's questioning this experience that's going
on. It doesn't need to, right?
And I don't need to prove it to anyone. I can't convince someone of something that I'm experiencing.
So if someone wanted to take off their glasses and have that, how would they do that? Like, have that experience?
Well, I don't know if they would have that experience. That's right. First of all. But I can give you some suggestions. For instance, if you wear glasses and you're wearing them all the time, try something. When you come home, remove your glasses when you open the door and put them in a little basket. You're not going to bump into the walls in your own house, regardless of the strength of your prescription. You will not miss where the bathroom is. You will not be able to see the person that you're living with. So where you feel totally safe, do a short experiment, 5 minutes. Notice how you feel. Notice all the feelings that come up. Oh my God, I'm not going to recognize someone. Oh, what if I don't see them in public? They're going to think that I'm being this or that. Oh my God, how will I get along? All these fears come up. But you're at home. You have nothing to fear right here. So you just allow that. You do a little 5 minute or 2 minute experiment. Then an hour later, maybe you extend it for an extra minute. Then when you get comfortable doing that, so when you come home each day, you leave your glasses at the door, after a while, you start to notice, oh my God, I can cook dinner, I can find my bed.
But you're not seeing any better, sharper.
No, it's not true.
Okay, maybe
you actually are.
Okay.
What happens is that when you remove your glasses, within very short order, mm-hmm, you can measurably increase your visual acuity. You don't have to take my word for it. You can download an eye chart from the web, put it on the wall, and check yourself. Within a half an hour, you'll be seeing better than you did when you first took
your
glasses off.
That is very interesting.
Okay?
Isn't it, Michael?
The next thing is, you come home, you know you can function in your own house. Maybe you walk around your house now, just to see what that feels like.
Outside, walk around your house. Okay.
Maybe you walk down the block a little bit. You keep expanding the space. And then there's a lot of websites now, mm-hmm, that sell glasses very inexpensively. If you can speak to someone that can show you how to reduce the prescription just a little, mm-hmm, bit, you order something that's very slightly weaker. I don't mean slightly weaker where you say, oh my God, I can't see. No, so slightly weaker that the only thing that it does is soften the world and soften you at the same time. Mm. And the response of that softness is that when you put them on, something goes, ah. Oh.
Mm.
And that ah actually causes a further reduction. What you get in touch with is that when you remove your glasses, you feel out of control. You feel out of touch. You feel like you're not going to be able to function. What I've come to notice is that those same feelings that come up when one removes their glasses are exactly the same feelings they had just prior to the first time they got their glasses.
So
the glasses literally anesthetize. They freeze into place these feelings of insecurity, of feeling out of control, that were there before our vision contracted. Why did our vision contract? Because we were in a contracted state.
Mm.
So now as you get in touch with these feelings, not as a child, but as an adult, and you realize, oh, there's actually nothing to fear at this moment, then all of a sudden everything begins to shift. And you can get very significant improvements in eyesight with no change in prescription. So you just gradually reduce the prescription and you see how far this journey will take you. You may not be able to eliminate your glasses, but almost everyone can reduce the prescription.
Amazing. This is basically outlined in your book, Take Off Your Glasses and See.
Absolutely.
Great. Yeah. What else do you have planned for yourself or in the future? Where are you going? Is it just this journey unfolding into the unknown?
What am I doing? I feel like I have to connect with the people.
And you are.
You know, it's not about marketing on the web or getting a lot of followers on social media. That's okay. But there's nothing like the real thing, baby. You know, there's nothing like sitting with a group of people, having a heart-to-heart conversation, someone coming up to you afterwards and saying, wow, that really touched my heart, or whatever. That's about as good as it gets. That's the ultimate prosperity without an extra cent in your pocket.
Mm. Well, I'm happy you called me to share some of your life experience.
It's because you're a sweetheart.
No, and we've known each other a long time, and I...
And I mean it, you're a sweetheart. That's why I called.
Thank you. Thank you. So the book again is...
Luminous Life.
Luminous Life.
How the Science of Light Unlocks the Art of Living.
The Art of Living, which is... How would you sum up the art of living? Everything we just said, would you say that?
Just what we're having right this moment. The indescribable love of just being here. Mm. That's the art of living.
Jacob Lieberman. What is your website?
JacobLieberman.org. And that's LIBERMAN. Come to this site. It's a lovely sight to see. And there's nobody trying to sell you anything. It's just fun to see it.
And Lieberman is life man, isn't it? Lieber.
It's man of love.
Man of love. Lieber. Oh, Lieber. Lieber.
Ich liebe dich.
Jacob Lieberman, Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. And if you have any questions, email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. And I've dropped into a place here with you, Jacob.
I guess it's contagious. Thank God it's not the flu.
It's better than that.
Better than the
it's
flu.
Life itself.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to New Realities again. This show was sponsored by PortalToAscension.com, AscensionConference.com. Look for the upcoming conference of Portal to Ascension, October 5th, 6th, and 7th, 2018, at the Atrium Hotel in Irvine, California. Go to the website. AscensionConference.com. Thanks for listening and good night.